Pacifica. This is Democracy Now!
And this morning, the president is tweeting that he wants to pull FEMA and the military out of Puerto Rico. How long do we have to stay in Puerto Rico, Mr. President? Until every Puerto Rican's name is taken off the Vietnam Memorial Wall or erased from the records of the Korean War, Afghanistan, and Iraq, as long as it takes. They gave their lives and died.
As President Trump threatens to withdraw federal relief workers from Puerto Rico, home to 3.5 million U.S. citizens, residents of the island and their supporters respond with outrage and disbelief. San Juan Mayor Carmen Yulín Cruz called Trump the hater-in-chief. We'll get response from Congressman Luis Gutierrez on Puerto Rico, as well as Trump's move to dismantle the Affordable Care Act and stop paying billions of dollars in federal subsidies to help cover poor people's health care. Then, the renowned psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton on President Trump.
Trump is on record for demanding something like 10 times the number of nuclear weapons. And that's what I call extreme nuclearism, a kind of embrace of the weapons to do everything that they can't do. The only thing nuclear weapons can do is destroy countries, cities, destroy human beings.
Robert J. Lifton on what he calls the apocalyptic twins, nuclear and climate threats.
Of the ultimate absurdity, that if we do nothing but what we're doing now, and it's what I mean by malignant normality, just go on using fossil fuels, we will do ourselves in as a civilization pretty much by the end of this century. Nothing could be more absurd than that.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump has threatened to withdraw FEMA from Puerto Rico and abandon the federal recovery effort there, as half the island still has no drinking water and more than 80% lacks electricity 3 weeks after Hurricane Maria. FEMA officials have also acknowledged there's a massive shortage of food being provided on the island, while health officials have warned hospitals are in dire condition. On Thursday, Trump attempted to blame Puerto Rico for the humanitarian catastrophe, tweeting, quote, "All infrastructure was disaster before hurricanes." Trump then tweeted, "We cannot keep FEMA, the military, and the first responders who've been amazing under the most difficult circumstances in PR forever." Trump's tweet sparked immediate backlash, both across the continental the United States and on Puerto Rico. San Juan's mayor, Carmen Yulín Cruz, said Trump is threatening to condemn us, quote, to a slow death of non-drinkable water, lack of food, lack of medicine. She also appealed to the United Nations, UNICEF, and the world to, quote, stand with the people of Puerto Rico and stop the genocide that will result from the lack of appropriate action of a president that just does not get it because he's been incapable of looking in our eyes and seeing the pride that burns fiercely in our hearts and souls, she said. We'll have more on Puerto Rico with Congressmember Luis Gutierrez after headlines. In more climate-related news, the death toll from California's drought-fueled wildfires has surged to 31, as hundreds more remain missing. On Thursday, Sonoma County authorities said they identified at least 10 of the victims and that the majority were in their 70s and 80s. The bodies were so charred, the only way to identify some of them was by the serial numbers on artificial joints or other medical devices. The fires have now burnt nearly 200,000 acres, roughly the size of New York City. In Vietnam, at least 50 people have been killed in floods and landslides after a tropical storm hit the northern and central parts of the country. Tens of thousands of people have been forced to evacuate as the flooding submerged more than 30,000 homes, killed up to 40,000 animals. One resident of the hard-hit northwest province of Hoa Binh said, quote, "It's impossible to fight against this water. It's the strongest in years," unquote. The climate change chaos comes as an investigation by The Guardian and Global credible witness, says more than 150 environmental activists and land defenders have been murdered this year alone, meaning 2017 is slated to be the deadliest year on record. Billy Kite of Global Witness said, quote, investors, too, have blood on their hands. They should not invest in projects linked to abuses and must speak out when defenders are threatened, unquote. A new report by the group Oil Change International says the world's largest international development banks invested more than $5 billion in coal, oil and gas projects last year alone. Environmental activists are calling for these banks to divest from fossil fuel extraction. President Trump has moved to dismantle the Affordable Care Act after Republican lawmakers repeatedly failed to repeal and replace President Obama's signature health care law. In a late-night announcement, the White House said it will stop paying billions of dollars in federal subsidies to insurance companies to help cover low-income people's health care plans. Experts say ending the subsidies will dramatically increase insurance premiums and could unravel the health care market. This comes hours after Trump signed an executive order that would allow insurance companies to sell cheaper policies with few protections and benefits, a move that could also destabilize the current health care market. We'll have more on health care later in the broadcast. President Trump is slated to announce today the U.S. will decertify the landmark 2015 Iran nuclear deal, although it appears Trump has now backed away from his plans to withdraw the U.S. from the deal entirely. Instead, the White House expected to instruct Congress to leave the agreement intact for now. Trump has come under massive domestic and international pressure not to unravel the landmark agreement. On Thursday, the Trump administration announced its withdrawing from UNESCO. That's the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization. This is the U.S. Chargé d'Affaires at UNESCO, Chris Hagedorn.
Second issue, unfortunately, this venue has become politicized, undermining the work of UNESCO across its mandate. It's become a venue for anti-Israel bias. And unfortunately, we are taking the decision to withdraw from UNESCO at this time.
In response, the director general of UNESCO said, quote, at the time when conflicts continue to tear apart societies across the world, it's deeply regrettable for the United States to withdraw from the United Nations agency promoting education for peace and protecting culture under attack. That's the Director General Irina Bokova. Hours after the U.S. withdrew, Israel then also pulled out of UNESCO. Both the London and New York police departments have launched investigations into disgraced movie producer Harvey Weinstein, who was one of the most powerful men in Hollywood until a slew of women came forward in recent days to accuse him of sexual harassment, assault, and rape. London police are investigating allegations of sexual assault dating back to the 80s. In New York, a 2015 New York police sting operation already recorded Weinstein admitting to groping the Filipina-Italian model Ambra Batalana Gutierrez. But the district attorney, Cy Vance, refused to press charges at the time. One of Weinstein's lawyers donated $10,000 to Vance's election campaign only days after Vance decided not to prosecute the case. In news from Guantanamo, hunger-striking prisoners say U.S. military officials have stopped force-feeding them in a move the prisoners and their lawyers say threatens to kill them. In an op-ed for The Guardian, hunger-striking Guantanamo Bay prisoner Khalid Qasim writes, they have decided to leave us to waste away and die instead. Now, as each night comes, I wonder if I will wake up in the morning. When will my organs fail? When will my heart stop? I am slowly slipping away, and no one notices, unquote. Qasim has been in prison for 15 years without being charged with a crime and writes that a hunger strike was, quote, the only peaceful way I thought I could protest. A Louisiana sheriff has sparked outrage after he lamented the scheduled release of nonviolent prisoners using language that evoked slavery and the U.S.'s long history of imprisoning African Americans in order to serve as free or cheap labor. This is Caddo Parish Sheriff Steve Prater.
I don't want state prisoners, okay? They are a necessary evil to keep the doors open, that we keep a few or keep some out there. And that's the ones that you can work. That's the ones that can pick up trash, the work release programs. But guess what? Those are the ones that they're releasing. In addition to the In addition to the bad ones, and I call these bad, in addition to them, they're releasing some good ones that we use every day to wash cars, to change oil in our cars, to cook in the kitchen, to do all that where we save money. Well, they're going to let them out.
In Portland, Oregon, six people were arrested Wednesday after they locked themselves to each other outside the Portland ICE Center to blockade a bus carrying detained immigrants to a for-profit immigrant prison in Tacoma, Washington. Meanwhile, in Washington state, two protesters have been convicted of disorderly conduct after they blockaded a highway to protest a rally by then-candidate Donald Trump and Lyndon Washington in May of 2016. Activists Josefina Mora and Thomas Kaplan have been sentenced to 10 days of labor on a jail's work crew after a judge threw out their necessity defense, in which they were arguing the civil disobedience was necessary to prevent the spread of fascism and hate groups, both locally and nationwide. This is Thomas Kaplan and Josefina Mora at the protest back in 2016.
So right now I have my arms in two tubes. Each side, and on my right there's Nia, and she is chained to a ladder, and on my left there's Thomas, and he's also chained to a ladder.
It's a community where white supremacy has been rampant since it's been colonized, and we're particularly drawing attention to Lyndon because here has been the center of Ku Klux Klan rallies and organizing for at least 100 years, and right now it's a hotbed for racism against farm workers. We're not going to allow Donald Trump to come to our community and spread hate and try to encourage the detention or the terrorism towards people of color and undocumented persons.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump threatened Thursday to withdraw federal relief workers from Puerto Rico as his administration faces withering criticism on its response to the humanitarian crisis on the island, which is home to 3.5 million U.S. citizens. More than a month after Hurricane Irma hit Puerto Rico and 3 weeks after Hurricane Maria, more than 80% of the island remains without power and water is in short supply. In a series of tweets Thursday morning, Trump seemed to hold Puerto Rico responsible for its own plight, writing, quote, "Puerto Rico survived the hurricanes. Now a financial crisis looms largely of their own making," says Cheryl Atkinson. Trump was quoting a reporter with Sinclair Broadcasting. He went on to write, "A total lack of accountability," say the governor. "Electric and all infrastructure was disaster before hurricanes. Congress to decide how much to spend. We cannot keep FEMA, the military, and the first responders who've been amazing under the most difficult circumstances in PR forever," the president tweeted. This comes after Trump's visit to Puerto Rico last week, when he complained that its recovery had, quote, "thrown our budget a little out of whack." On the island, Puerto Ricans responded with disbelief to Trump's latest comments.
Ay, santo.
Oh, God, this guy Trump is sick. He's not well. But we're Americans. We're part of the nation. How is he not going to help when we need it? I think it's bad on his part.
Trump, I'm not in agreement with the words he uses. Because I've always considered since I was born that us Puerto Ricans are part of the United States, and many of our relatives have sacrificed their lives for the United States. So the words he uses, I don't consider to be anything good.
Meanwhile, San Juan Mayor Carmen Yulín Cruz took to Twitter to call Trump hater-in-chief and said in a statement Trump is threatening to, quote, "condemn us to a slow death of non-drinkable water, lack of food, lack of medicine." The mayor also appealed to the United Nations, UNICEF, the world to, quote, "stand with the people of Puerto Rico and stop the genocide that will result from the lack of appropriate action of a president that just does not get it because he's been incapable of looking in our eyes and seeing the pride that burns fiercely in our hearts and souls," unquote. Federal officials admit there's a massive shortage of food in Puerto Rico, where 2 million people need food, but FEMA is serving just 200,000 meals a day. For more, we go to Chicago, and we're joined by Congressman Luis Gutierrez, Democrat of Illinois. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Congressman Gutierrez.
Thank you,
Amy. Your response to the series of tweets that the president of the United States wrote yesterday.
It's utterly disgraceful. People are dying on the island of Puerto Rico, dying, because there are infectious bacteria now attacking people. I don't know how much worse it's going to get, but I fear, Amy, it's just going to get a lot worse. I do not see the resources arriving on the island. And I think the healthcare epidemic that is going to confront the people of Puerto Rico is going to be without precedent on the island of Puerto Rico and maybe anywhere in the United States of America. And so our response to the president is we're going to stay there until we get the job done, until things are normalized, until things are regularized on the island and they can stand on their own two feet. And I am so proud of the people of Puerto Rico. Although they cut those scenes out when the president tweets those videos of the Puerto Ricans on the roads, in their homes, in their towns, cleaning up, helping one another, showing each other love and compassion, and creating a community with very little. The food isn't getting to a lot of places. The healthcare isn't getting. And for the life of me, I cannot understand why the richest, most powerful nation in the world with the most powerful military in the world isn't evacuating the elderly, those that are in bed, those that are on dialysis, those that are receiving treatment for cancer. You can go down the list. Those that are so vulnerable. Why aren't we putting them in a safe place in New York? In Chicago, in Hartford, in Lorain, Ohio, all over in Chicago, we have our homes ready to receive our compatriots and take care of them. We have hospitals. We have schools. Why aren't they transferring those who wish to leave the island, especially making a priority of those that are sick? I just do not understand it. And death will continue. The president liked to say, Amy, 16 certified. Well, we're now over 45, and everybody knows that that's not the number, that the undercount of those that are dying is huge, and they're not counting those that are dying as a result of the lack of medical care, medical attention, of food and of water. There are parts of Puerto Rico that 3 weeks after the hurricane, they have not put in bridges, temporary bridges, so that people can escape from where they are trapped. That's 3 weeks, the most powerful military in the world, and we're not putting people in a safe place.
Can you respond to what President Trump said in this tweet when he said, we cannot keep FEMA, the military, and the first responders who've been amazing under the most difficult circumstances in PR forever? It is 3 months. It's 3 weeks after the hurricane. Compare it to what the U.S. has done for Texas, for Florida, Katrina, going back to Louisiana there.
Think about it. By this time, we had 60,000 people in New Orleans. We had hundreds of airplanes and cars and trucks and buses to get people out of harm's way. And we stayed there for years because we had to rebuild. And we're still in parts of New Jersey rebuilding years later. We'd stay until the job gets done. I want to repeat for the viewers, there is a wall with over 50,000 names etched of those that lost their life during the Vietnam conflict. On that wall are hundreds of names of Puerto Ricans. And it seems to me just so, I don't know what the word is to describe it, but wow. Here is a president of the United States who said, I got bone spurs, but I want so I can't serve in the military. And he wants to walk away from those who have given, in many cases, the greatest sacrifice you can to a country, right? The greatest tax, the tax of your blood, of your limb, of your life. And he wants to walk away. So I understand the outrage. On the other hand, Amy, let's remember, Puerto Rico is a colony of the United States, and they want to stay there forever. They want to own it. They want to make Puerto Rico not part of the United States, but owned by the United States. Let's give you an example. Yesterday was a big thing. The headlines were relief going to Puerto Rico. Yeah, there was relief going to Puerto Rico. $5 million loan. Why a $5 million loan? Why aren't we giving them a grant so that they can pay their bills and keep the government open? No, what we do is we give them a loan. Now, that is going to be added to the $74 billion, $5 billion more. How does that help? But remember, in that bill yesterday, what did we do? We erased $16 billion worth of debt to the National Flood Insurance. Why can't we release some of the debt from the people of Puerto Rico? Debt that was incurred because we imposed on the island of Puerto Rico the U.S. Merchant Marines under the Jones Act, the most expensive shipping. If you add up the costs since 1920 of the imposition of the Jones Act, making us use only American-built ships with American people running the boat, if you add all that up, there's a $72 billion. So don't tell me about what is owed. A lot is owed. The destruction of our agriculture, the destruction of our land, some of our most beautiful Vieques and the bombing. What is that all worth, Mr. President? And he's always putting everything kind of in an accounting machine. And you know what? You leave Puerto Rico, and that's just another reason we should impeach you as president of the United States.
Finally, President Trump, in a late-night move announcement, the White House announced that it will stop paying billions of dollars in federal subsidies to insurance companies to subsidize low-income people's health care plans. Can you respond to this move?
Yeah. The poor that finally had access to health care, the working poor that had access to health care, mothers. Most mothers with, you know, single mothers with children, the elderly, those that we finally were able to bring inside the realm of safety of health care. That's who he wants to take away health care from. And then he wants to allow these minimalist insurance policies so employers can give that to their employees so that people will once again, I hate to, but it's true. So that people, again, because they don't have appropriate health care, will again die in this, the richest, most powerful nation in the world. The president of the United States wants to do this. Clearly, here's what they're going to do with the money, Amy. It's no coincidence that their next move is to give a tax break to the wealthiest in this nation. And they need to balance their budget in order to give that tax break to the wealthiest by taking it from the poorest in the nation. I think it's just so shameful.
Congressman Luis Gutierrez, we thank you so much for being with us. Democrat of Illinois, co-chair of the Immigration Task Force of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, the world-renowned psychiatrist, Dr. Robert J. Lifton, on President Trump and the apocalyptic twins of nuclear war and climate change. Stay with us.
Las calles de nuestros barrios nunca toman prisioneros, quiebran al que no resiste, sea local o sea extranjero. Ay, la paciencia no existe con los que son majaderos, cada víctima es culpable si cayó por traicionero.
Streets by Reuben Blades here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we spend the rest of the hour discussing what our next guest calls the apocalyptic twins, nuclear and climate threats. This week, NBC News reported President Trump called for a nearly tenfold increase in the U.S. nuclear weapons arsenal during a meeting with high-ranking military leaders. It was after this that Secretary of State Rex Tillerson reportedly called Trump a moron. On Wednesday, Trump lashed out at NBC on Twitter, suggested NBC's broadcast license should be revoked as punishment for its reporting. Today, Trump is slated to announce the U.S. will decertify the landmark 2015 Iran nuclear deal, although it appears Trump's now backed away from his plans to withdraw from the U.S. from the deal entirely. Instead, the White House expected to instruct Congress to leave the agreement intact for now after he came under enormous domestic and international pressure not to unravel the landmark deal. In the last week, Trump has also repeated threats of war against North Korea, tweeting, quote, presidents and their administrations have been talking to North Korea for 25 years, agreements made and massive amounts amounts of money paid hasn't worked, agreements violated before the ink was dry, making fools of U.S. negotiators. Sorry, but only one thing will work, he tweeted. In brief comments to reporters Saturday, Trump was asked to clarify that remark, as well as a cryptic comment he made last week during a meeting with top generals in which he warned about the calm before the storm.
Nothing to clarify. Well, you'll figure that out pretty soon.
You'll figure that out pretty soon, he said, when asked about the calm before the storm, what it was. Meanwhile, the U.S. is struggling to recover from a series of hurricanes and now wildfires that climate scientists have linked to climate change. The 10th hurricane this year, Ophelia, has just been named. There have not been 10 hurricanes in one season since 1893. Well, our next guest wonders if the storms have contributed to what he calls a shift in our awareness of climate truths. On Thursday, Democracy's Now! Shneur Sheikh and I sat down with Robert J. Lifton, leading American psychiatrist, author of more than 20 books about the effects of nuclear war, terrorism, genocide. His new book is titled The Climate Swerve, Reflections on Mind, Hope, and Survival. His past books, Death and Life, Survivors of Hiroshima, for which he won the National Book Award, The Nazi Doctor, Medical Killing and the Psychology of Genocide, and Witness to an Extreme Century, a memoir. Dr. Lifton's also a distinguished professor emeritus of psychology and psychiatry at the City University of New York. I began by asking him to talk about what is now happening between the U.S. and North Korea and Iran, and President Trump's closest aides expressing concern that Trump is unraveling.
I also belong to a group called The Duty to Warn, which is a group of psychiatrists and psychologists who feel we have the right and the obligation to speak out about Trump's psyche when it endangers the country and the world. And what we're seeing, you mentioned the potential unraveling of the pact with Iran. There's also the potential unraveling of Donald Trump, which seems to be occurring. It's hard to read him because his behavior, as I understand it, is completely solipsistic. He sees the world through his own sense of self, what he needs and what he feels, and he couldn't be more erratic or scattered or dangerous. So the exchange with North Korea has to be terrifying to all of us. It's not something that can be controlled. You have two leaders who are bent on hyperbole and intense threat to the other and have their own motivations, each of which is hard for us to read. But we can read the danger that they represent, particularly since we've learned recently that Trump is on record for demanding something like 10 times the number of nuclear weapons. And that's what I call extreme nuclearism, a kind of embrace of the weapons to do everything that they can't do. The only thing nuclear weapons can do is destroy countries, cities, destroy human beings. But since they came into being, there's been an impulse to embrace them and see them as saviors, prevent war, keep the world going, maintain authority on the part of the nuclear weapons possessing nations. So Trump is into that extreme nuclearism. And at the same time, as you mentioned, with the other apocalyptic twin, the terrible and very real threat of climate change, global warming, he and his followers are blocking every reasonable effect that was put forward at Paris in 2015, and through which the world seeks to confront what may be the gravest danger it's ever faced. That's where we are.
Well, I mean, to go back to what you said initially, the group that you're a part of, the psychiatric group, you're a contributor to a book called The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump. What are some of the key concerns about Trump that you and your colleagues raise?
Well, I wrote a letter together with Judith Herman to the New York Times in which we raised two issues. One was his relation to reality. which is, I would say, solipsistic and untenable and very dangerous to everyone.
What do you mean solipsistic?
Solipsistic with, from within the self. In other words, he only sees the world from within his sense of self. He can't have empathy for others. He can't really think into the future, the consequences of his actions, because he's totally preoccupied with the immediate event and how he can deal with it or manipulate it as emerging through the perception on the part of his sense of self. That's very extreme. People who are psychotic behave that way. And yet, for the most part, Trump is not psychotic. That combination makes him really dangerous. So that relationship to reality is one thing. And the other thing that Judith Herman and I wrote about was his difficulty with crises and his extreme behavior and attack mode instead of any kind of balance which a president needs to deal with a crisis. So those were two. And in this regard, I write about what we call malignant normality. So he's the president. A president takes actions. There's a tendency to normalize them because, after all, he is the president. He's in charge. When what is called normality is completely malignant and harmful. And I came to that idea through work on Nazi doctors. They were expected to reverse healing and killing and really take the lead in killing in Auschwitz. I'm not accusing any Americans of being Nazi doctors. I'm saying that this is a model of malignant normality, and we now face it with Trump and his administration.
I wanted to ask you about your group, Duty to Warn. Vanity Fair has a piece where Steve Bannon, the disgraced White House aide, said he told President Trump that his concern should be the 25th Amendment, you know, not being impeached, but the cabinet voting him out. He says something like Trump has a 30% chance of making it through his term. You are a psychiatrist. Can you talk further about what it would take, if it wasn't an impeachable crime, for to remove President Trump, why you believe he is a danger right now?
It's unclear whether or how Trump will be removed from or resigned from the presidency before the completion of his term. One doesn't know that. It will probably, in my judgment, be a political rather than a psychological act. I mean, one could take the 25th Amendment, and his cabinet and vice president could attest to his unfitness for being president.
That, but the cabinet are his appointees.
Yeah, it doesn't seem very likely, does it? But rather, what's happening now is that there's a dialogue between this psychological, psychiatric group and Congress people in which we are bringing information about Trump's unfitness, which becomes part of the political dialogue. It will probably
be— Are you talking to Congress members?
Yes, yes. People from this group are talking to Congress people. And it will probably be a political decision that removes Trump. And that means an election process and the issue of whether you get a Democratic House or Senate and other political issues that will become very important. But this is now part of the dialogue. Everybody knew that Trump was bizarre, strange, was unreliable, unfit to be president. It's been known by the hypocritical Republicans for a very long time. But putting it forward by psychologists and psychiatrists gives it a certain greater authority and becomes part of that dialogue and recognition. That's the way that I see it, rather than a clear-cut removal through the 25th Amendment. Though one doesn't know, because there's more and more evidence about Trump's campaign's collusion in Russia and potentially about obstruction of justice, and all these could play a part. He could attempt to fire Mueller, as he's threatened to do, and that could bring about a constitutional crisis. So we don't know. We can't predict what process will occur. The psychological now is in dialogue with the political.
I wanted to read to you the New York Times editorial on Thursday. One finger on the button is too few. And they write, the broad debate over President Trump's fitness for the difficult and demanding office he holds has recently been reframed in a more pointed and urgent way. Does he understand and can he responsibly manage the most destructive nuclear arsenal on Earth? The question arises for several reasons. He's threatened to totally destroy North Korea. He's reportedly pressed for a massive buildup in the American nuclear arsenal, which already contains too many, 4,000 warheads. And soon he'll decide whether to sustain or set a course to possibly unravel the immensely important Iran nuclear deal. It goes on to cite Corker, who said he's leading to World War III, and Rex Tillerson, who reportedly called him a moron. And the Times goes on to say, Mr. Trump's policy pronouncements during the campaign betrayed either profound ignorance or dangerous nonchalance. At one point, he wondered why America had nuclear weapons if it didn't use them. At another, he suggested Japan and South Korea, which have long lived under American security umbrella, should develop their own nuclear weapons. But nothing he has been quite as unsettling as is his recent tweet storms about North Korea, fire and fury, the calm before the storm. And so they are saying, they're calling for, many have hoped and still hope, Trump's aggressive posture is mostly theater designed to slake the thirst for attention, keep adversaries off guard. But there's no underlying strategy to his loose talk. And whatever he means by it, Congress has been sufficiently alarmed to consider legislation that would bar the president from launching a first nuclear strike without a declaration of war by Congress. It wouldn't take away the president's ability to defend the country. They say that's a sound idea and could be made stronger with a requirement that the secretaries of defense and state also approve any such decision. As things stand now, the Atomic Energy Act of 1946, passed when there was more concern about trigger-happy generals than elected civilian leaders, gives the president sole control. He could unleash the apocalyptic force of the American nuclear arsenal by his word alone and within minutes.
Well, any restriction on the president, any president, but especially Trump, on his capacity to initiate a nuclear war, any restriction on that is profoundly desirable. It's a strange world, to say the least, when the generals are there to restrain the civilian. The generals aren't, on the whole, known for their military restraint. There are exceptions. With the Vietnam War, as you know, it was initiated by civilians, the best and the brightest, as it was called. The military was at first a little reluctant, then entered it and became corrupted by it and created what I came to call atrocity-producing situations. That could happen here, too, with the generals who are ostensibly restrainers, allowing him, being unable to prevent him from initiating some form of war, being themselves drawn in and then corrupted by it. That's a really dangerous sequence. Anything that holds that back or in check is desirable.
This year, the Nobel Peace Prize was awarded to ICAN, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. Do you see that as significant?
I do see that as very significant, because there is a mindset that rejects nuclearism. Nuclearism is the embrace of weapons to, as I said before, to do all the things they can't do and to utilize them instead of what should be utilized in the way of peacemaking. So giving the Nobel Peace Prize to a group that seeks to outlaw all nuclear weapons recognizes that mindset, the critical mindset toward nuclear weapons. And, you know, I was part of the anti-nuclear movement, still am, but particularly the doctor's role in anti-nuclear work. And I think we have reason to believe that the whole anti-nuclear movement from all directions was a significant factor in preventing the use of nuclear weapons since Nagasaki in 1945. It doesn't mean that we're on fine ground with nuclear weapons. It's still extremely dangerous, as we're discussing. But the prevention of their use was certainly influenced by anti-nuclear movements and a rejection of nuclearism.
Your work with bringing out the voices of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki victims, I wanted to turn to one of those victims. In fact, when we interviewed ICANN after they won the Nobel Peace Prize, they talked about the voices of the Habakusha being so critical. In 2016, we spoke to Setsuko Thurlow, a survivor of the U.S. bombing of Hiroshima, August 6, 1945, now an anti-nuclear activist who works as a social worker in Toronto, Canada, serving Japanese-speaking immigrants. She described that day, August 6, 1945.
I was a 13-year-old grade 8 student at the girls' school, and I was mobilized by the Army, together with a group of about 30 schoolmates, and we were trained to act as a decoding assistants. And that very day, being Monday, we were to start the day's work as a full-fledged decoding assistant. At 8 o'clock, we had the morning assembly, and the major and I gave us a pep talk. And we said, we will do our best for Emperor's sake. And at that moment, I saw the bluish-white flash in the windows. I was on the second floor of the wooden building, which was 1 mile or 1.8 kilometer away from the ground zero. And after seeing the flash, I had a sensation of floating in the air. All the buildings were flattened by the blast and falling. And obviously, the building I was in was falling, and my body was falling together with it. That's the end of my recollection.
That was Setsuko Thurlow. She was a survivor of the U.S. bombing of Hiroshima. And in your book, The Climate Swerve, Reflections on Mind, Hope, and Survival, you talk about the apocalyptic twins, nuclear and climate threats. Talk about this voice. Well, most of the Habakusha have died out at this point.
Survivors have a special form of witness. And many of them, including particularly Hiroshima survivors, as you know, so-called Hibakusha, have traveled around the world and told their stories. And that does us a service, and it does them a service as well, because it gives meaning to an otherwise intolerable kind of experience. They sense that they know something that the rest of us don't know. And what they know, what they've learned, is the capacity of our technology, our weaponry, to destroy our entire species and much of the planet. They know that in a visceral way, in a way that we don't know.
Dr. Robert J. Lifton is a leading American psychiatrist, author of more than 20 books. His latest, The Climate Swerve, Reflections on Mind, Hope, and Survival. When we come back, I ask him about climate change, which he's called the apocalyptic twin of nuclear war. Stay with us.
Black girl, we'll leave this fight to someone else for now. You can close your eyes, let your hair down. Breathe in, breathe out. Yes, there will be battles you sometimes lose.
Lullaby by Tasha, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue our conversation with Dr. Robert J. Lifton, leading American psychiatrist, author of more than 20 books. On Thursday, Democracy Now!'s Nermeen Sheikh and I spoke with him about his new book, The Climate Swerve, Reflections on Mind, Hope, and Survival in the Midst of the Massive Hurricanes and the Wildfires in California. I asked him about climate change, what he's called the apocalyptic twin of nuclear war.
Climate change, yes, is the apocalyptic twin. And we saw in those images of the hurricanes just in the last couple of months, and still, a kind of apocalyptic damage, the destruction of cities, of islands, of most of Puerto Rico, a large area, and doubts about the capacity to recover and to really prevent the most long-standing damage to these places. There has to be a kind of prospective survivor, somebody who imagines this happening. But now we have visual evidence in these hurricanes, not caused by climate change, but rendered much more extreme, according to much scientific evidence. We have evidence which the rest of us can take in as prospective survivors of further climate damage that threatens our whole civilization. I call them apocalyptic twins because only these two threats, these two developments, can destroy the human species. I no longer speak so much of climate change denial, but rather climate change rejection. It's impossible not to, in at least one part of one's mind, recognize that there is something called global warming and that it's very dangerous to it, to us, and that we're contributing to it. It doesn't mean that one accepts it. One recognizes it partially. The human mind can be very contradictory. One can both recognize it and reject it. Reject it because it's contrary to one's anti-government stance. You need governments to cooperate to do anything about it. And because it's antithetical to one's identity and to one's worldview, and also to one's financial sponsors, all that feeding climate rejection. But even as they try to make adaptation, how are you going to restore these coastal areas? The issue of climate change arises more readily. So although we are not satisfied with the amount of emphasis on global warming, it's making its way into what I call species awareness or a climate swerve. One wishes it would happen faster, but it is happening.
But it's interesting that you say that this climate swerve or change in climate mindset is happening at the same moment that the Trump administration is perhaps the most vocal in renouncing climate science or in climate rejection, as you call it. I want to go back to President Trump last month when he traveled to Mandan, North Dakota, and celebrated his decision to pull out of the landmark 2015 climate deal while speaking outside an oil refinery.
In order to protect American industry and workers, we withdrew the United States from the job-killing Paris Climate Accord. Job killer. People have no idea. Many people have no idea how bad that was. And right here in North Dakota, the Dakota Access Pipeline is finally open for business. I also did Keystone. You know about Keystone. Another one. Big one. Big. First couple of days in office, those two. 48,000 jobs. Tremendous, tremendous thing. I think environmentally better. I really believe that. Environmentally better.
So that was President Trump speaking on September 6th in Mandan, North Dakota. It was just about a year after the Dakota Access Pipeline guards unleashed dogs on protesters, Native American protesters, water protectors who were trying to protect the planet and not have that DAPL pipeline built. It was after, just after Hurricane Harvey had inundated the greater Houston area, and Hurricane Irma was just making landfall. He chose this moment to come to this controversial spot where hundreds of Native Americans just down the road from the oil refinery had been jailed for their fight for water protection to announce once again, look at what I've done, pull out of the Paris Accord and greenlight these pipelines.
But that story isn't over, and the story continues. It has proven very difficult for Trump to pull out of the Paris Accord. As soon as it was announced, there was a heartening response on the part of governors and mayors all over the country saying that their states or their cities would follow the Paris Accord. And there was an even more intense international response, a joint statement by Germany, France, and Italy that the Paris Accord was irreversible, and by China that they would continue their involvement in the Paris Accord. And then the Trump administration issued a series of so-called clarifications. Well, we'll go to the meetings. Well, we don't exactly have to pull out. We'll renegotiate. In other words, obfuscating the whole issue, which is very Trumpian and not so surprising. The reason why it's difficult for him to pull out of the Paris Accord is that there's a worldwide consensus about it that's more powerful than any person, even the most dangerous person in the world, Donald Trump. And in that sense, again, we like more. It's outrageous that Trump would try to pull out of a world-saving accord, or at least something in the direction of that. It should really be criminal for a president to do that. But at least we can say that the climate swerve or the species awareness, the idea that we're all in a members of a single species in deep trouble, as I put it, all that prevents him from pulling out absolutely and leaves the whole matter unclear.
Is it your sense that there are sufficient restraints on Donald Trump acting unilaterally on either of these fronts?
Of course there
climate
are not.
Or nuclear?
You'd have to have total restraints for them to be sufficient with a man like Donald Trump. Of course there aren't sufficient restraints. And whoever depended upon generals to restrain a civilian in so many different areas. And we don't know the outcome. I'm not, in my book or in my work, promising that we've accomplished enough to prevent climate damage and real disaster from happening. It's happening already. What I'm saying is that there has been a shift in mindset that makes possible the actions, the sensible actions necessary to curb global warming. We still haven't taken those actions fully. And, you know, at the beginning of my book, I speak of the ultimate absurdity that if we do nothing but what we're doing now, and it's what I mean by malignant normality, just go on using fossil fuels, we will do ourselves in as a civilization pretty much by the end of this century. Nothing could be more absurd than that. But at least we have a beginning shift in mindset that allows us to take reasonable action. And that's what Paris was all about.
I wanted to ask you about the quote you begin your book with. You quote the American poet Theodore Rettke saying, "In a dark time, the eye begins to see."
Yes, that's a beautiful line from a very great poet. I've used that throughout my career because it's, in a way, what my work is about. I've studied a lot of descents into darkness, Hiroshima, the Vietnam War, Nazi doctors and others, Aum Shinrikyo in Japan, and I always feel there's something to be learned from what happened. And it doesn't mean that we're guaranteed to make good use of our history and never do it again. It does mean that some kind of knowledge can come from it. And I see myself in that way as what I call a witnessing professional, trying to use my professional knowledge to bear witness to and in some way reveal more about this kind of darkness.
Can you talk more about the Nazi doctors? I mean, you devote a chapter to them here, but, I mean, your work spans, you are 91 years old now.
Yes.
You have so much wisdom and both experience and all you have brought to this. Tell us what we should learn from what you learned from these men.
With the Nazi doctors, when a German doctor who would be a member of the Nazi Party was assigned to Auschwitz, he was expected to do so-called selections and send most arriving Jews to the gas chamber. That was considered normal behavior for a doctor in Auschwitz. Some of them had difficulty with it, but ultimately they adapted to it. This is rendering professionals a hired gun for a malignant version of normality. And I learned that in extreme ways, professionals can be put to use for killing rather than healing. That's what happened in Nazi Germany. But we also saw expressions of that, not quite as fully expressed, but with American psychologists and, for a while, psychiatrists engaging in torture, and that being an expected normal behavior.
You're talking about the American Psychological Association cooperating with President Bush.
That's right. I'm talking about both individual psychologists and psychiatrists, and then the American Psychological Association collaborating with the torturers. I call that a scandal within a scandal. It's a scandal that professionals are doing that, but it really shows that we have to, as professionals or as anything, recognize what our work is being used for and where it's being put in connection with despotic behavior. The scandal within a scandal is an association that's supposed to watch over the ethics of a profession joins in torture, or at least protects those who join in torture. But all that was exposed by a movement from within psychologists, from within the American Psychological Association, with the help of reasonably good leadership on the part of the American Psychiatric Association, who said it was wrong for any psychiatrist to be in the room during an interrogation that could spill over into torture. Yes, that those were examples of malignant normality, not in Nazi Germany, but in relation to democratic United States of America. And with Trump, of course, malignant normality becomes the rule because he's president. And what a president does tends to normalize potentially bad, evil, or destructive behavior.
Dr. Robert J. Lifton, leading American psychiatrist. His latest book, The Climate Swerve, Reflections on Mind, Hope, and Survival. That does it for our show. We want to wish Robbie Caron a very happy 10th anniversary with Democracy Now! And our speaking schedule this weekend. Juan Gonzalez speaks at noon today at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. I'll be speaking tonight at 8 p.m. in Albany at the SUNY Albany Symposium on Telling the Truth in a Post-Truth World, along with Bob Schieffer, historian Douglas Brinkley, and New York Times reporter Glenn Thrush. Then on Saturday, Juan Gonzalez will speaking at that same Albany Symposium at 11:30. Check our website for details. That does it for the show, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Danita Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Caron, Hani Massoud, Tarina Nadura. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.